You are listening to 93.3 FM WNRB LP Wausau. Free people, free radio. Coming up next, a show the NSA always loves listening to, and stop tapping my phones. This is The Mike Cannon Show.
Warning. The views expressed on The Mike Cannon Show, or the segments brought to you on this indie media radio show, do not necessarily reflect the views of WNRB nor WNRB's hosts.
Guess who's back again.
Mike Cannon.
This is my boomstick!
This could be dangerous. You should go back.
I know you're out there. I know that you're afraid. You're afraid of us. You're afraid of change. You're afraid of us. You're afraid of change.
Lungs and livers and bladders and hearts. You'll always save a bundle when you buy a Jingle Parts. Slings and chestins and spines and brains, all at warehouse prices, but the quality's the same. Jingle.
And now, the man who has sold every major organ in his body and got cash back, Mike Cannon.
Hello and welcome to another exciting edition of the Indie Media Radio program, The Mike Cannon Show. That last little Jinko advertising was a holdout from last week's Halloween special I forgot to put on last week's show. It is from an underground goth rock opera opening up in select cities across the nation called The Repo Man. Anyhow, it kind of looks kind of fun. Speaking of fun, I love putting together last week's show and working on the Mike Cannon Show in general. It's been a fun run. It has lasted for about 3 years. However, I feel that The Mike Cannon Show may be coming to its end. I find it difficult to do all the stuff I'd like to do by putting together the show religiously each and every week. I like to concentrate on more freelancing media reporting and keeping alive This Week in Radical History segment I produce. I'm not sure, perhaps I'm just getting a little bit burnt out. But who knows, I really love doing this show, and it'll always be tough to give up. At any rate, just to warn you that if the Mike Cannon Show abruptly ends, you'll still be able to catch the work I produce on RadioForAll.net website. That is a site where most of the stuff I bring each and every week can be found as well. So again, my work and segments you've come to know and love on this show can always be found at RadioForAll.net. Not all segments come from that site. Some I've found over the years in various other pages. If you'd like info on where you can find stuff like Black Agenda Radio or This Week in Palestine, to name a few, or if you have any questions or comments, please consider dropping me a line at themikecannonshow@hotmail.com. Cannon is spelled C-A-N-N-O-N, so that's all one long run-on word, themikecannonshow@hotmail.com. Well, let's get back into this week's lineup then. As you know, I like to bring each and every week alternative programming from around the country and the world, giving you some non-corporate voices, voices of six mega corporations that control 90% of all television, newsprint, and radio do not allow you to hear. These voices are once again coming to you this week. We'll be starting off this week, as we always do each week, with Eat the State and their anti-authoritarian news and review segment. And by the end of the hour, we'll be hearing a segment I produce each week called This Week in Radical History. Between now and the end of the show, you'll be hearing the shorter pieces I bring you each week, like Media Minutes, Peak Oil Check-In, Radio Spin, Women's E! News, just to name a few. All these alternative voices give you a perspective not offered by mainstream media. So let's get into it right here, right now, on The Mike Cannon Show. And as always, thanks for listening.
You take the blue pill. The story ends. You wake up in your bed and believe whatever you want to believe. You take the red pill. You stay in Wonderland. And I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes.
A new United Nations report has revealed major U.S. cities, including New York, Washington, Atlanta, and New Orleans, have levels of economic inequality that rival cities in Africa. The report found the United States has the highest inequality and poverty after Mexico and Turkey, and the gap has increased rapidly since 2000. The life expectancy of African Americans in the United States is about the same as that of people living in China and some states in India.
It is 8:29, and we have with us live in the studios, as we do just about every week, Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat This State. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Ted Stevens having his day in court.
Yeah, speaking of, we haven't done police blotter in a while, but I thought we should bring it back for a special campaign edition, because in addition to Rossi and to Scott White, we had the national spectacle this week of Ted Stevens being convicted on 7 felony counts of essentially lying to investigators. And again, Stevens, who is not only one of the founders but the patron saint of What Up in Alaska, they very proudly called the Corrupt Bastards Club. Well, surprise, surprise, he's a corrupt bastard. this will come as a shock. A shock, I tell you. You know, Stevens was convicted on all 7 counts, and his defense to all this was, these well-connected lobbyists and oil executive friends gave me gifts that were worth hundreds of thousands of dollars, sure, but I didn't even realize that they'd given me gifts. I had no idea that they had or who they were from. And, you know, for a man in his position who entered Congress 40-some years ago as a neophyte politician and is now a multimillionaire, it's easy to understand how you could get confused about all the gifts of worth tens or hundreds of thousands of dollars that you get from your quote-unquote friends. And it's easy to see how you could overlook a few of them.
And his defense that, well, I didn't ask them to do these things and to give these things to me. It's like, hello, that's the nature of a gift. You don't ask for it. It just is given to you.
Yeah.
And the giver... In this case, may ask for something in return. That's the whole point behind banning gifts to senators.
It's not a gift. It's an exchange. It's called quid quo pro. And given that Stevens is notorious as one of the legislators in D.C. who is most adamant about pork barrel projects, earmarks, slipping little things into the budget to take care of his friends, you could say those investments were very, very well paid off over the years. So anyway, one of the things that is taken into account in sentencing for these crimes is whether the defendant is repentant or not. And Stevens most definitely is not. He was back in Alaska campaigning for re-election yesterday.
And, you know, I thought there was something, a rule that barred senators who are convicted felons from serving in Congress.
Well, there are, but he hasn't been. He has. That would take effect pending appeal, and he's already said he's going to appeal.
Right. So he could very well be elected, sent to the Senate, and be a convicted felon at the same time.
And not only that, but if his appeals fail, and you know the
then
nature
it opens
of these,
a whole can of worms of how do you replace him?
Well, you replace him with a special election.
Yeah.
But he is our Mitch McConnell,
which
who's the Senate minority.
The taxpayers, by
yes.
The way.
Well, not nearly as much as Stevens has already cost them over the years. But Mitch McConnell, the Senate minority leader, has already said there's 100% certainty that Stevens is going to be expelled from the Senate if his conviction holds up, which it almost certainly will. So we are looking at having and Stevens is behind in the polls. And, you know, to be honest, even though he's a widely revered figure up there, I would be astonished if we're going to have Ted Stevens in the Senate come January. And that can only be good news for the rest of the country and for Alaska, by the way. Just think, you could get rid of, they'll still have Sarah Palin. That's you know, can't get everything up in Alaska at the same time.
All right. That then takes us on to this week's economic news.
Yeah. I just want to talk for a bit about the bailout bill, as Jav mentioned earlier, that when you pass these things in a hurry, the wording isn't very specific. And in this case, Congress made the wording in the bailout bill so vague that it's allowed the Treasury to use the money for all kinds of different things. I believe the wording just
paying
said,
off friends.
Yeah, just said, let's bail out the housing market, you know, and do what we can to save the financial industry. And so, of course, the Treasury is using that money for all kinds of things. It just, the Treasury just released the list of the folks who are going to get the first $125 billion of the bailout money. And what it turns out is that all 8 of the biggest banks in the United States took a chunk of that money, whether they actually needed it or not. And those 8 banks included banks that have bought out some of the banks that were failing earlier, like J.P. Morgan Chase, for example. They bought out, I believe it was Bear Stearns in February, and then they bought out, not Merrill Lynch, Bank of America bought out Merrill Lynch, but then they bought out Lehman Brothers.
And WaMu.
And, or they bought out WaMu. Lehman Brothers was allowed to fail. So, and J.P. Morgan Chase is considered one of the better banks in the U.S. right now, but they took a $25 billion chunk of money from the Treasury.
You expected them to turn it down, maybe?
Yeah, no, that's the thing. J.P. Morgan Chase, Wells Fargo, Bank of America, Citigroup, each took $25 billion from the Treasury. Morgan Stanley and Goldman Sachs, and I'm shocked that Goldman Sachs took anything because they are probably the best situated investment bank and arguably the best situated bank in the U.S. right now. They took $10 billion each. Bank of New York Mellon took $3 billion. State Street took $2 billion. And on and on and on. So, you know, what are they going to use the money for? Supposedly the Treasury says, well, they're going to use the money to loan out to businesses and loosen up the credit markets so that money can flow again and people can borrow and spend, et cetera, et cetera. But J.P. Morgan Chase was caught by a New York Times reporter the head of J.P. Morgan Chase was caught telling his employees that, oh, no, we're not going to use the money to increase lending. In fact, we're going to tighten lending because of the nature of the financial situation right now. We're going to tighten our lending. We're going to use this money probably for acquisitions and to buy out banks that are failing. So in essence,
and executive retreats.
Yeah, right. And maybe some stock buybacks, etc. So and that's true of most of the other banks, because not only did the big banks line up and all take a cut, but a lot of mid-sized regional banks have lined up to take a chunk of the money as well. These mid-sized banks have also said that they're going to use the funds not necessarily to lend out money at a local level, but to buy up other banks. The list is, you know, J.P. Morgan Chase says that they're going to buy out other banks, but PNC Financial, they just announced they were going to acquire National City Corp. They took $7.7 billion from the Treasury in order to assist with that merger. SunTrust took $3.5 billion. They say they're going to use it to make acquisitions. Other banks that will make acquisitions include Regions Financial. They took $3.5 billion from the Treasury for that purpose. BB&T has also said they're going to buy out other banks. They took $3.1 billion from the Treasury. And our very own local Washington Federal said that, oh, yeah, we want this cheap money, man. These other banks are going for you know, bargain basement prices. We want to look at acquisitions. So we're taking $200 million from the Treasury to do that. So, you know, I think, very interesting things about this is how is that money structured? Now, the Treasury said that they're gonna loan out this money to banks, so it's structured as a loan, right? And what they're gonna get in exchange is they're gonna get preferred stock issued to them in exchange. This is non-voting stock in these banks, which means the Treasury has no control over any of the business decisions that any of these banks have. And that non-voting preferred stock is going to pay a 5% dividend to the Treasury. So in essence, it's a cheap loan. But here's the deal. In 5 years, if the banks don't pay that money back to the Treasury, the dividend on the preferred stock goes up to 9%. So if you look at that, it's structured just like an adjustable rate mortgage. And you might ask, okay, now, is that a good idea? Because generally, you know, some of these banks, sure, they're healthy now, but if the crisis continues, goes on for a year or two or three or four, those banks might not be able to pay that money back. And then you're looking at, in 5 years, the Treasury saying, well, maybe we need to give more money, maybe we need to extend the low interest rates, whatever. It's just like, it's kind of like hooking the banks on an adjustable rate mortgage the same way that, that Americans were hooked on adjustable rate mortgages.
Isn't that kind of poetic, though?
It is in a way, but it's not going to stabilize the financial system, which is what the whole idea
is. And it's certainly not going to put credit back into the system.
And then the Fed argues, too, that the Fed and the Treasury together argue that it's a good idea that these banks are using this money to buy up distressed banks, because then the FDIC doesn't, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, doesn't have to step in and bail out failing banks, doesn't have to pour taxpayer money into these failed banks. But we're using taxpayer money anyway. If the FDIC stepped in to rescue some of these failed banks, they would pay back depositors up to a certain fairly high limit now, up to the $250,000 limit on deposits, so the depositors would get back their money. Bondholders might get a little bit of money back, too, once the assets of the bank are sold. And then shareholders and company executives, which who own huge numbers of stock options, those guys would get nothing, which I think is poetic justice, and that's what ought to happen. That's what happens when the FDIC steps in. But by pouring money into banks in the way that Treasury is doing and encouraging healthy banks to buy out these failed banks, what they're doing is they're rescuing shareholders and they're rescuing these CEOs and executives who made bad decisions and who own a lot of stock options. They're basically and they're rescuing bondholders. So, and I think that that's not poetic justice. That's just perpetuating
that's
the
theft.
Problem. Yeah, yeah, it's theft, and it's perpetuating the problem.
The other interesting thing, I forget where I saw this, but apparently somebody caught an internal memo within Treasury this week where the question was basically, how much of this money can we disperse by on or about January 20th?
Yeah, and
which just happens to be Inauguration Day.
Yeah.
So if you recall 8 years ago when there was this big manufactured hoo-ha about some of the Clinton employees as they were leaving the White House taking the silverware or, you know, messing with the keyboards on computers, now they're not just taking the silverware, they're taking the carpet, the lighting fixtures, they're taking
the
everything.
The cash in the safe, they're taking everything.
They're taking everything they can loot, basically, on their way out
so
the door.
So it makes you wonder if there's going to be much of anything left when Obama becomes president in January. My fingers are crossed. But in addition to what I've already said about problems with pouring money into banks in this way and encouraging mergers, is that now anybody, anywhere in the U.S., any company anywhere in the U.S., is thinking, gosh, if banks can get this kind of a deal, maybe I can get this kind of a deal too. All I would have to do is set up a subsidiary of my company, put all my debts and financing into that subsidiary, call it a financial holding company, and then go to the Fed and say, hey, I need a piece of the bailout package. And in fact, we're starting to see this. GM, General Motors, people may be following the problems in the American auto industry, which gambled for too long on gas-guzzling SUVs. GM
had a higher profit margin.
Yeah, right, up until fairly recently. And GM and Chrysler are looking at trying to work a merger in order to save one or both of the companies. In order to do that, they need money from an outside source. They can't get it from banks, which are not loaning for this purpose right now. And so GM is trying to work a deal where they put, like I just described, they put a lot of their debts and a lot of their financing into GMAC, their financing portion of their company. They're trying to spin it off as a financial holding company and trying to get billions from the U.S. Treasury that they can then turn around and use to finance this merger. I think that's a slippery slope.
But if GMAC became a separate entity, how would you transfer the money?
It's not separate.
It's not separate now.
It's a subsidiary. No, and they're not talking about making it separate. They're talking about making it a subsidiary.
Oh, I see.
So then they can. It's an Enron style thing.
As opposed to a division, which is now. Yeah.
right. And in corporate terminology, these things basically boil down to the same thing. It's still connected to GM. GM wants to use that unit. Call it a bank and say it's our bank, pour money into it so then we can use the money for the merger. And there are other companies that are going to try to do this as well. Don't think this is going to end soon. So, and of course the Fed says, well, don't worry because taxpayers will eventually get all this money back. But, you know, when you structure it like an adjustable rate mortgage, there's no guarantee. In addition, the Fed and the Treasury have been taking on additional risk as well. The Fed also started loaning money directly to companies through its commercial paper funding facility. About $144 billion went out this week in short-term cash flow loans to companies in all kinds of industries in the U.S. because the Fed is now doing what banks won't do, which is make short-term cash flow loans to businesses. That's an exposure to a lot of risk that the federal government has never, ever done before. And the Fed as well decided...
But the Fed's not part of the federal government, is it?
Well, it is and it isn't. Sort of like Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are and they aren't. Well, and the Fed is also decided this week that they were going to extend credit lines of $30 billion each to the central banks of Brazil, Mexico, South Korea, and Singapore. Again, that's taking on a lot of additional risk to bail out a global financial system. And you might ask, why are we bailing out the global financial system? Well, we are the source of the problem. And when you've got a president who's not looking at dealing with the source of the problem and a Congress which is twiddling its thumbs, then it leaves the Fed and the Treasury to try to deal with the global system rather than dealing with the cause of the problem, which is stabilizing the U.S. housing market.
Okay. Is that it?
Yeah, that's it. We got to move on and talk about some other things.
All right. Moving on to developments at Guantanamo.
Yeah, six Algerians they used to be Algerians about 10 years or so ago, they applied for citizenship in Bosnia, and they received their citizenship in Bosnia. But once the war on terrorism came along, the Bush administration decided that it was going to pick up anybody that they thought were terrorism suspects and stick them in Guantanamo. Well, these six former Algerians, who are now Bosnian citizens, have spent some 6 years in Guantanamo, and this week the terrorism charges against them were dropped by the U.S. government. Also, most of the key evidence against them has been proved to be unreliable. And so these six Algerians are still Algerians, now Bosnian citizens, are still being held in Guantanamo. They are the last of the European citizens who are being held there. And it came out this week that not only have the charges been dropped and the evidence against them is not credible at all, it came out this week that in order to get them and put them in Guantanamo, the U.S. Government made threats to the NATO coalition in Bosnia, saying, "We will pull out of the coalition unless you surrender these guys to us."
And these guys had actually been put on trial in Bosnia.
That's right. A Bosnian court had declared the evidence against them insufficient and that they should be released. And yet the U.S. government put pressure on the Bosnian government to turn these people over. And then immediately put them in Guantanamo and has held them there incommunicado for 6 long years. And I think it's significant that when the U.S. government makes a threat like that, we're going to pull out of the Dayton Peace Accord, we're going to let Bosnia go back into a civil war, and we're going to let the peace deal completely collapse, we're going to let the Bosnian government collapse unless you give us these six guys. That's an act of terrorism, I think.
Yeah, and evidence, we don't need no stinking evidence.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, and finally, airstrikes in Syria.
Yeah, what happens if an October surprise is launched and nobody is surprised? we had such a scenario this week. The United States forces in Iraq launched a cross-border strike into Syria that killed several people in Syria. The Syrian government says they were civilians, women and children. The U.S., of course, military, which has never been dishonest about these things in the past, said that they were terrorists. The ostensible purpose of this was that you haven't heard much about this in a while, the whole shibboleth of foreign fighters in Iraq being responsible for the insurgency. That's been pretty widely discredited, but that was trotted out this time again, saying that the foreign fighters that are coming to Iraq to help with al-Qaeda in Mesopotamia are coming through the Syrian border, and they've asked Syria to crack down on them, etc., etc. The Syrian-Iraqi border is basically open desert, and much of it is not guarded because it is such difficult terrain to traverse. But rather than trying to work the situation out, say diplomatically, and we know we have diplomatic relations with Syria. How do we know this? Because we do extraordinary rendition of terror suspects to the Syrian prisons in order for them to be tortured.
Right.
So clearly there's a working relationship there.
There is some kind of working relationship
but not a good one. But rather than do that, we decided 8 days before an election to do an unprovoked strike into a sovereign country and see if, hey, maybe we can get lucky and they'll retaliate.
Yeah, and you know, it's so cynical. I mean, the U.S. government spokespeople basically admitted outright that, oh, yeah, the Bush administration is doing this because they want to preserve the option of striking against terrorism suspects, not convicted terrorists, terrorism suspects, on the soil of any country anywhere without first getting the okay of that country's government. We reserve the right to kill anybody anywhere at any time if we suspect them of doing something we don't like. And
that's called murder, isn't it?
Yeah, generally that's referred to as murder, or it might also be referred to as terrorism. But they basically admitted that the Bush administration is doing that now because they want to preserve this option, and they are hoping that the next president will take it up as a valid option and keep it going.
Yeah, and various people in the Bush administration have been very explicit about saying that that's their goal, is to see that this the so-called Bush doctrine of preemptive strikes and the ability to kill anyone and anywhere at any time for any reason is preserved permanently. They're very attached to that.
All right. Talking as we do every week with Job Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, both with Eat the State. And where do people find Eat the State?
Eat the State comes out every couple of weeks with news and tips. Our editorial endorsements are online. Some people have had trouble finding them. That's because at this point they're in a previous issue. You go to back issues at www.eatthestate.org, click on the October 9th issue, and it'll come right up, Election 08, Tragedy or Farce. But if you have trouble finding it, email us at editorial@eatthestate.org, and we'll be happy to send you the link. And again, if you have comments, tips, feedback, want those election results or recommendations rather, or the results, because, well, quite frankly, we've rigged all the machines, then drop us an email. Our email is editorial@eatthestate.org.
You know, you only had one shot to make it right, to do the right thing. So listen to the Mike Cannon Show.
Fora TV. The world is thinking.
I've laid out what the arguments are going to be, where the right is going to come back. They've bought themselves insurance against an Obama presidency, and that insurance is the economic crisis. I'm not saying they did it on purpose, but they're ready to use it to say all of these things that are being promised, health care, alternative energy, investment, that it's not affordable. So people need to be ready with alternatives for how to afford it. And I'll tell you that the defense contractors are getting scared. They're worried that this is going to mean cutbacks to them. And I think that we should make that fear come true and say... But in general, I just think that people, I know there are people here who've been involved in organizing for Obama. There has to be a planning that starts now for the day after the election, to use this moment, to stay mobilized, and push back against this very organized lobbying that's coming from the defense contractors, from Wall Street. We know what their agenda is. It's not mysterious. But it's, what's going to happen is that we are going to be asked to sacrifice the dreams of actually moving to, a sustainable ecological model on the altar of this crisis that's been created. And there has to be a strategy for refusing that. I actually think these arguments are winnable. I think they're I think we're in a moment where they're uniquely winnable because the ideologues on the right have just broken every single one of their rules, which really weakens their hand. So it's a time to get in there and think big. I think Obama has said this to his supporters, that it's a time for big ideas. And also he said, I'm going to need you. But my worry is that the culture around the Obama campaign, and this is where I think the McCain campaign is quite right, is very much celebrity, a very much celebrity model. Very much, you know, a super fan culture as opposed to an engaged citizen culture. And that has to change. But I have a lot of hope that it will.
You are listening to 93.3 WNRB LP Wausau. Free people, free radio.
I can't trust Obama. I have read about him, and he's an Arab.
Why are we elected an Arab when we're at war with Iraq and Iran?
I'm afraid if he wins, the black will take over. It's not a Christian. This is a Christian nation. What is our country going to end up like?
When you've got a Negro running for high president, you need a first stringer. He's definitely a second stringer.
That guy gets elected, he hangs around with terrorists.
Who's the terrorist?
Obama.
Obama's a terrorist, don't you know that?
Obama's a Muslim, he's a terrorist himself.
Commie faggot!
Socialist swine. Well, I really worry when we get people, when you get the kind of rhetoric that you're getting at these rallies now, I think it's really imperative that the candidates try to calm people down.
European socialist!
You think they
Bill Ayers, you scumbag!
You think they should die, sir?
Everyone dies, don't they?
He seems like a sheep, or a wolf in sheep's clothing, to be honest with you. And I believe Palin, she's filled with the Holy Spirit, and I believe she's going to bring honesty and integrity to the White House.
Obama and his wife, I'm concerned that they could be anti-white, that he might hide that.
What did you expect? Welcome, Sonny. Make yourself at home. Marry my daughter. You've got to remember that these are just simple farmers. These are people of the land. The common clay of the New West. You know. Morons.
That was right before the break. Naomi Klein, author of Disaster Capitalism, discussing how Obama will be handcuffed to bring any real change. And that was followed by the vitriol at the Palin-McCain rallies and their racist supporters. And that last bit was from the movie Blazing Saddles. And this is my editorial on the elections. As far as the elections go, I'm in the camp of some deep thinkers before me. The first, anarchist and feminist Emma Goldman, who famously once said, "If voting ever really changed anything, they would have made it illegal." And one other famous quote, whose voice can say it a lot louder and clearer than I can. Here is George Carlin.
Give these people a voting day every year so that they'll have the illusion of meaningless choice. Meaningless choice that we go like slaves and say, "Joe, I voted." The limits of debate in this country are established before the debate even begins, and everyone else is marginalized. They're made to seem either to be communists or some sort of disloyal person, a kook, there's a word, and now it's conspiracy. See, they've made that something that should not be even entertained for a minute, that powerful people might get together and have a plan. Doesn't happen. You're a kook. You're a conspiracy buff. So, the only way you cure that, death, bloodshed. I don't advocate it, but I see that it's really the only answer.
Like most people, I suspect, the path to come to these conclusions was paved with the bones of hope and a mortar of the blood of innocence, both figuratively and literally. You see, the last time I voted was for Clinton, when I was told then, as we're being told now, that, insert Clinton or Obama here, they can really change things. Our hopes was dashed time and time again when Clinton passed bill after bill, proving he's just a Republican light version. Though bringing us a good economy, though arguably off the backs of others in the world, he also put 2 million more blacks in jail, passed NAFTA, displacing or killing many indigenous economies and people around the world, and taken away welfare for the poor while bolstering welfare to the rich. So even if Obama is not really a centrist Republican-like candidate that I'm pretty sure he is, he'll have even a greater mess to deal with than Clinton did when he came in office. And in the end, like Clinton, no real change for the good will come of it. Profit-based capitalism is too entrenched to ever be displaced. I'll gladly take back my words if Obama gets us universal health care like the rest of the civilized world, but I know that is a safe bet and will never ever happen. So as I see this huge surge in interest of the election of Obama as a counter to a really, really poor job Bush did, and even poorer choice of McCain, it'll still take 6 to 8 years for all those Obama enthusiast supporters to feel the way that I felt when my generation was enthusiastic for Clinton. And I pity those who have not spent the time and energy not exploring alternatives to capitalism model as they slide further down the path of ruin, both economically, but also spiritually as they see the truth behind the curtain, as it'll be too late to pull back the curtains for others to see with them. Of course, Obama is a better choice than McCain. He will make the cage more palatable than Bush-McCain would. However, it is still a cage, and the capitalist barbs on the bars will always slowly pick you to death, as long as you choose to live within this cage. So, prove me wrong. However, I suspect I will see you in about 6 to 8 years from now, if we can even make it that long. And the only question then will be, are you still fighting to get out of that gilded cage? Or will you join us as equals to fight the good fight, my sisters and brothers?
Good evening.
The first,
the second,
third, and last presidential debate.
I'm Jim Brokaw, NBC News.
By now, we've heard all the talking points. So let's try to tell the people tonight some things that they haven't heard.
Thank you, Bob.
Tom, thank you.
Thank you very much, Jim.
Well, thank you,
Tom. Thank you,
University.
I think everybody understands.
I think everybody knows now we are in the worst financial crisis since the Great Depression.
8 years of failed economic policies promoted by
President
Bush
and supported by Senator McCain.
And our best days are ahead of us.
Senator McCain's statement earlier said that he thought the fundamentals of the economy were sound.
Let's look at as graded by the National Taxpayers Union and the Citizens Against Government Waste.
Senator McCain talks a lot about earmarks.
Likes to talk about earmarks a lot.
Let's be clear
about earmarks.
Earmarks account for about $18 billion of our budget. In last year's budget. And when I'm president, I will go line
by line through every item,
page by page.
So when Senator McCain is proposing a $300 billion tax cut
to some of the wealthiest corporations in America,
I want to provide
a tax cut for 95% of working Americans.
95%.
You know that Senator Obama is proposing some $800 billion in new spending now?
Our tax rates for business in America is 35%.
Ireland pays 11%.
He says that he's going to give you a $5,000 tax credit.
I want to give every American family a $5,000 refundable tax credit
so they can get anywhere in America
the health insurance you want.
Senator McCain mentioned looking at our records.
And so let's look at our records.
An across-the-board spending freeze is a hatchet, and we do need a scalpel.
Senator Joe Lieberman and I,
we're currently spending $10 billion a month in Iraq. And they have a $79 billion surplus.
We've got to stop sending $700 billion a year to countries that don't like us very much. Alternative fuels, wind, tide, solar, natural gas.
You voted for four out of five of those budgets. When the war started, you said it was going to be quick and easy. You said that we were going to be greeted as liberators.
I looked into Mr. Putin's eyes, and I saw three letters, a K, a G, and a B.
The failed economic policies of the last 8 years.
The last eight years.
Thinking about the middle class.
My friends.
And you really have to pay attention to words.
With unseemly haste, the corporate media consensus seems to have rushed to the conclusion that the so-called Bradley effect is a myth, that white covert racism will not be a significant factor on November 4, and that the polls are accurately reflecting a looming landslide for Barack Obama. Obama may indeed win by a landslide, but such an outcome most certainly would not signal that race and racism are no longer huge factors in American political life in general, or in this election cycle in particular. Indeed, the zeal with which corporate pundits seek to declare the end of race as a defining element of U.S. politics serves only to confirm its overreaching presence in political culture. The Bradley effect refers to the tendency of some whites to lie to pollsters about their intentions to vote for a black candidate. Not only is it asserted that the Bradley effect is no longer operative, that whites are telling pollsters the truth this time around, but some pundits claim that the phenomenon is an urban legend. As a journalist since 1970, I have observed the Bradley effect in action on many occasions, with white votes for black candidates in local races consistently lower than the polls predicted. The Bradley effect is an historical reality, one that every political campaign in racially mixed jurisdictions has to take into account. Those who attempt to discredit the Bradley effect are, in reality, seeking to declare racism in America a non-issue, unworthy of further attention. They have seized on Barack Obama's campaign as proof that black agitation is outdated and even harmful to the national interest. Obama has encouraged whites to believe that once he's in the White House, black complaints about racism in public life can be deemed irrelevant, that the long debate over white skin privilege and entrenched institutional racism will be over. The most shameless proponent of this baseless notion is Frank Rich, a supposedly liberal columnist for the New York Times. In a piece titled, In Defense of White Americans, Rich cites Obama's high polling marks as sufficiently compelling to declare that, quote, it's past time to come to the unfairly maligned white America's defense, unquote. Rich ridicules the idea that, quote, a black guy is doomed among Reagan Democrats, Joe Sixpacks, Rednecks, Joe the Plumbers, or whichever condescending term you want to choose, unquote. Well, Rednecks, Reagan Democrats, and all kinds of racists may well vote for Obama. He has praised their hero, Ronald Reagan, effectively declaring that the world-class race-baiter wasn't a racist after all. Obama has blamed his own former pastor, Reverend Jeremiah Wright, and every other black that complains about racism for creating harmful diversions that stand in the way of solving the nation's real problems. Barack Obama is successful because he coddles racists in hopes of getting their vote. But a black candidate's willingness to malign other blacks and pander to racists does not signal the end of racism. Rather, it confirms that race is central to U.S. political life. Racists can vote for Obama and feel good about themselves, but you won't find me celebrating. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford.
The Vet Who Did Not Vet.
A cautionary tale. Once there was a proud old vet who had a job he wished to get. He hoped to be the head of state, but who would be his running mate? Lieberman or Colin P? Hutchinson or Rudy G? Liddy Dole or Condi Rice? The Mormon guy whose hair is nice? Thompson, Gingrich, Bloomberg, Huck? Sarah Palin? What the f***? Meet my maverick, said the vet. She killed a bridge and sold a jet. This hockey mom is real and plain. She's just your average six-pack Jane. Like Rudy G, she ain't New York. Like Lieberman, she won't touch pork. She'll shake things up and make some noise and stand up to all those good old boys. She's real down home. She's just like you. Except one thing. It's just not true. Because, you see, this vet he did not vet and chose a brunette he'd hardly met. And when you screen your nominees, like hiring help at Applebee's, one has to think you've lost your mind. 'Cause look at all these things you find. An earmark queen who spends and spends and hires all her high school friends. That nowhere bridge, she loved it so. And when it died, she kept the dough. She watches Putin rear his head from her state house tanning bed. Wants to ban the books you read, hopes to see her state secede, shuns the press when she campaigns, thinks it's cool to hunt from planes, hasn't really passed reform, isn't sure the earth gets warm, has a thing for voodoo prayers, and wants to wipe out polar bears. Who knows just how you found her, John? It's W. Bush with lipstick on. And because this vet chose not to vet, he used your life to play roulette. So spin the wheel and place your bet, 'cause if he croaks, here's what you'll get. You'll stay up nights and moan and fret with thoughts of wars and bombs and threat of crashing stocks and endless debt, a disappearing safety net. Your chest is tight, you're doused in sweat, you're filled with rage and deep regret. Your tongue is dry, your pants are wet, you lash out on the internet and throw things at your TV set. But here's one thing you can't forget. It hasn't happened yet.
Don't be scared. You are listening to the Mike Cannon Show. Okay. Be scared.
Gonna rise up, take what's there. Cause finally the tables are starting to turn. Talking about a revolution.
This week in Radical History for the week starting November 3rd. Inspiration came from the Slingshot organizer. Radical info can be found at the Daily Bleed website. And some audio for this week's show was borrowed from the Radio Roots crew at WBAI in New York.
There is something going on in the ether.
The kids are now moving back into the street.
For every Martin they cut down, there must be 100 Martins to step into his shoes. Hey, hey!
This week in Radical History for November 13th, 1755, the Penobscot Indians in Maine are declared to be enemies and rebels and traitors, and bounties are offered up to colonists for both male and female scalps. Also, November 3rd, 1883, Supreme Court declares Native Americans are aliens in the United States lands. Also on this date, 1903 in Colombia, in the province of Panama, with the secret backing of President Roosevelt and the new Panama Canal Company, Panama secedes. It is hurriedly recognized by the United States government within 3 days, declaring that the patron of Panama is the United States of America. And surprise, grants permanent and perpetual lease to its now new patron of the United States, all future Panama Canal use. Roosevelt sends in the United States Marines to force Colombia off their new lands. People, the time has
come. This is your Radio Roots reporter, Crystal Graham. On this day, November 3rd, in 1957, a dog named Laika became the first living being sent into space while aboard the Soviet Sputnik 2. Laika's preparation for 7 days of space in a tiny cabin took a great toll on her body. She was kept in progressively smaller cages for long periods of time, which deteriorated her health. The intense simulations also doubled her pulse and skyrocketed her blood pressure. The public was told decades later that Laika, who was a stray mixed hunting breed, died from stress and overheating hours after the launch. At the time, some scientists believed flights by non-human animals were necessary before human missions. But the Sputnik 2 mission and the U.S. use of chimpanzees for space exploration sparked a global debate about the mistreatment of animals and animal testing in the name of science. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you to never let the past slip away.
This week in Radical History for November 4th, 1796... America signs the treaty with Tripoli, which includes the following statement, quote, "The government of the United States is not, in any sense, founded on Christian religion," unquote. There you go, right-wing nut jobs. Also, November 4th, 1933, 3,000 farmers demonstrate in Neillsville, Wisconsin. This action to free 3 jailed leaders in the milk strike. During the Depression, desperate farmers attempt to raise, ruinous, low milk prices set by the large dairy plants. Their preferred tactic was to halt milk production. Led by the Wisconsin Milk Pool, they gathered on roads leading into Wisconsin cities and dumped tons of fresh milk into the sewers. Violence erupts across the state, and a striker on the road near Madison is shot to death. To break the strike, the governor calls out the National Guard. Also in the state in 1977, CIA Director Helms pleads no contest to lying to the United States Senate about his and the U.S. administration's involvement in Chile.
Badges. We ain't got no badges. We don't need no badges. I don't have to show you any stinking badges.
Also on the state in 1984, Nicaragua, the nation holds its first free elections in 56 years. Sandinistas win by 63%. U.S. has a heart attack. Also on the state in 1988, prisoner B.C. Kimberlin is placed in solitary confinement until after the U.S. presidential elections for claiming that he sold marijuana to right-wing darling and vice president candidate Dan Quayle.
Badges. We ain't got no badges. We don't need no badges. I don't have to show you any stinking badges.
Okay, this is just too funny, and truth is often stranger than fiction. In 1993, right-wing blowhard Rush Limbaugh's book, See, I Told You So, goes on sale. In it, it states, if people are doing drugs, they ought to be accused, they ought to be convicted, they ought to be sent up. Well, in 2003, he was caught in the police sting doing drugs. After that conviction in 2006, he'd be found with having possession of someone else's Viagra while returning from Haiti, a notorious sex tourism spot for the rich and famous. And Rush Limbaugh would say on his radio show about the trip, I had a great time in the Dominican Republic. I wish I could tell you about it. Of course, he's never sent up, as his book suggests, to do to all drug users.
Remember, remember the 5th of November, the gunpowder, treason, and plot. I know of no reason why the gunpowder treason should ever be forgot.
Popularized by the movie V on this date in 1605 in England, the gunpowder plot to blow up the English Parliament was detected while leader Guy Fawkes was captured.
I remember how the meaning of words began to change. How unfamiliar words like collateral and rendition became frightening. While things like Northfire and the Articles of Allegiance became powerful. I remember how different became dangerous. I still don't understand it. Why they hate us so much.
I want this country to realize that we stand on the edge of oblivion. I want every man, woman, and child to understand how close we are to chaos. I want everyone to remember why they need us.
People should not be afraid of their governments. Governments should be afraid of their people.
Remember, remember the 5th of November, the gunpowder treason and plot. I know of no reason why the gunpowder treason should ever be forgot.
Also on November 5th, 1855, Eugene Debs, labor activist, socialist politician, lives. His belief in the people was very genuine, and his vision of socialism, quite unlike the state machine pictured in Marx's Communist Manifesto, is quoted saying, "Hearing his views, I could not help exclaim, 'Why, Mr. Debs, you're an anarchist.' 'Not Mr., but comrade,' he corrected me. 'Wouldn't you call me that?' Clasping my hand warmly. He assured me he felt very close to the anarchists, that anarchism was the goal to strive for, and that all socialists should also be anarchists. Socialism to him was the only stepping stone to the ultimate ideal." So I guess that makes Obama halfway to being an anarchist, huh? Well, I wouldn't hold my breath. Also on November 5th, 1928 in Colombia, 5,000 banana workers strike against United Fruit Company owned by United States owners. 1,000 people would be killed to protect corporate profits. Also November 5th, 1969, the Chicago 8 became the Chicago 7 when the mistrial was declared in the case of Bobby Sale and a new separate trial was ordered. After repeatedly asserting that his right to have an attorney of his own choosing or defend himself, Sale had been bound and gagged in the courtroom. He is sentenced to 4 years for contempt of court. The sentence is later reversed. Sale was never convicted of any connection with that week's charges from the Chicago DNC protests. Not learning from past mistakes, the government is now trying to prosecute under terrorism charges the RNC 8, eight Minneapolis activists. Their terrorism charges is related to the organizing against the RNC in St. Paul last month. Deja vu all over again. People, the time has
come. This is your Radio Roots reporter, Ayanna Hay. On this day, November 7th, 1837, white abolitionist Elijah P. Lovejoy was shot and killed by a mob of pro-slavery partisans in Alton, Illinois, where he was the editor of abolitionist newspaper called the Alton Observer. Pro-slavery groups in Illinois had previously destroyed three of Lovejoy's printing press by violently seizing them and throwing them into the river. When word got around that a new printing press was to be delivered, a mob of people surrounded the printing warehouse in an attempt to burn it down. Lovejoy was killed with a shotgun as he attempted to stop the pro-slavery mob from entering the building. I guess the fight for independent media in America has been going on for a long time. Yeah, I said it. This is your Radio Roots reporter, Ayanna Hayes, reminding you, never let your past slip away.
Also November 6, 1887, Eugene Pottier, poet and revolutionary, dies. Participant in the Revolution of 1848 and elected to the Paris Commune. Condemned to death for his activities, Pottier fled to England and then the United States, later returned to France, where he continued writing poetry. He's best known today for the writing of the Internationale, which was put to music in 1888. The song, adapted by workers worldwide, is anarchistic to its core.
Oh.
Also on this date, November 6, in 2006, the Daily Bleed website, whose data I like to use for this show, had compiled databases to create this great service to all us radicals. Thank you to the People's Calendar at the Daily Bleed website, and happy anniversary. This week in radical history, for November 7, 1919, Palmer's reign of terror begins as 3,000 anarchists are imprisoned without bail at Ellis Island. You know where the Statue of Liberty stands nearby? Also on November 7, 1936, the International Brigades, including Lincoln Brigade, seize its first action in fighting the fascists in Spain. Lastly, for November 7, 1959, the Taft-Hartley Act is invoked by the Supreme Court to break a steel strike. This act put major restrictions on labor ability to organize, the government effectively siding with and giving a lot of power to industrialists. People, the time has
come. This is your radio reporter, Fashina Jones. On this day, November 8th, in 1800, a fire swept through the United States War Office, destroying the papers, records, and books that were stored there. Some government officials immediately suspected arson and possible political cover-up. America's complete military history prior to the 1800s was lost in the fire. Between 1784 and 1800, the War Department was responsible for veteran affairs, naval affairs, militia and army matters, as well as Indian affairs. The Secretary of War was allowed to spend 70% of the federal budget. The War Department was in overall control of internal security and diplomacy. I wonder what they could have possibly been trying to hide. Sounds a little shady to me. Yeah, I said it. This is your Radio Roots reporter, Fashina Jones, reminding you, never let the past slip away. Say it, say it, say it.
Also on November 8th, 1868, Powder River Country, including the Black Hills, is given to Lakota, quote, forever, unquote, by U.S. treaty. Within a decade, white settlers, business interests, and army would seize the entire region.
Badges. We ain't got no badges. We don't need no badges. I don't have to show you any stinking badges.
Also on that date, in 1897, Dorothy Day is born. An American journalist turned anarchist, social activist, and ultimately a weird devotee of Catholicism. She became well known for her social justice campaigns, including defense of the poor, forsaken, hungry, and homeless. Day, founder of the Catholic Worker Movement in 1933, espoused nonviolence and hospitality for the impoverished and the downtrodden. Though the Catholic Church will never make her a saint, we'll gladly recognize her as such. On this date in 1974, in a federal court, charges are dropped against the 8 Ohio National Guardsmen for killing the 4 anti-war protesters at Kent State University. It was there on May 4, 1970, brave National Guards troops, called in to suppress student rioting and protest the Vietnam War, killed the 4 Kent State students and injured 9 when they fired into the crowd with 60 rounds. The guardsmen literally appeared to have gotten away with murder. Previously undisclosed FBI files revealed that 1. FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover felt the victims deserved to be shot. 2. Hoover eagerly followed Nixon's instructions to knock down, that is, to discredit, essentially accurate news reports of the shooting, and 3, that Hoover relayed the order and his top aides boasted that we scotched those accurate news reports.
Tin soldiers and Nixon coming, we're finally on our own. This summer I hear the drumming for dead in Ohio. Gotta get down to it, soldiers are cutting us down. Should have been
This has been This Week in Radical History, produced out of the Glee Glee Studios. Inspiration for this piece came from the Slingshot Organizer. Google the Slingshot Collective for more info. Audio for this week's show was borrowed from the Radio Roots crew at WBAI in New York. And radical info can be found at the People's Calendar at the Daily Bleed website. Google the Daily Bleed for more information. And happy birthday, Daily Bleed. So until next week's This Week in Radical History, I am always and forever yours in a struggle, Mike Cannon.
Gotta get down to it. Soldiers are cutting us down. Should have been gone long ago. What if you knew her and found her dead on the ground? How can you run when you know? We'll be right back.
soldiers and Nixon's coming. We're finally on our own. This summer I hear the drumming. For dead in Ohio. 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 For dead in
You are listening to 93.3 WNRB LP Wausau. Free people, free radio.